Welcome to the Big Mike Fund Podcast, where you learn about advanced wealth building strategies from real estate investing to creating massive ROI and secured retirement profits. So pour yourself a cup of coffee, grab a notepad, and lean in, because Big Mike has got the mic, starting now.
Welcome to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. I'm the Big Mike, Mike Zlotnik. Today, it is my distinct pleasure and a privilege to welcome Frances Newton Stacy to the podcast. Hi, Frances.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you very much for coming on the podcast. Frances comes to the podcast as an incidental meeting. We met on an airplane. It was a great meeting, talking about being at the right place at the right time. And she's a very distinguished economist, a trader. Stacy works for Optimal Capital, and she's a frequent guest on Fox Business News, a commentator on central bank policy and its effects on the economy. Also, Frances does appear on CNBC from time to time, and she's just a great economical mind. Anytime I speak with her, I am just overwhelmed by her great wisdom. So thank you again for coming on the podcast.
Oh, thank you for the flattering introduction. My pleasure.
So very, very quickly, could you tell us a little bit about you? I had the pleasure and a privilege to meet your husband the other night. We went out for some Russian food here in New York, and he's a great NASCAR engineer, which is a story of its own. But could you tell the audience a little bit about you? Where do you live? Things you like to do, family, all that stuff. Just couple of minutes.
Sure. Yeah. So we live, we split our time between Northern California and Nevada, spending more time in Nevada these days. It's very advantageous from a tax perspective. And I predicted the financial crisis 10 years ago and I traded it. And then spent the last 10, 11 years kind of studying central banking policy and really trying to understand the business cycle. I mean, what makes the economy go up? What makes it go down? And how do you recognize some of the early flags in the cycle? My enjoyment is basically looking at all of this and watching the markets. And on the weekends, I don't want to know anything about politics or markets. So I spend a lot of time watching cooking shows or doing activities along that vein.
I'm sure that's more fun for you to do on weekends. My wife got me into watching some food channels too. It's actually very, very exciting to watch somebody else cook great food. So, but
Ken says it would be much better if you could actually taste it, but he still is kind enough to watch it with me.
Yeah, it certainly is exciting. But let's talk a little bit about economic policy and what's going on in the stock market today, and just general, where are we at? It feels like the volatility just shut up. We heard also some kind of a repo market crisis. And if you get a chance, could you just shed a little bit of light on this repo market? It's a technical term, but would love to hear your thoughts on what is a repo market? Why did we just have liquidity crisis? And what it was, what happened, really? And what do you think about current economy?
Well, so as far as the current economy goes, I think we've now had the longest bull run in history, really. And it was a result of having the Fed inject a lot of money into the system after the financial crisis under a program called quantitative easing. And when it comes to monetary policy, I just like to keep it very, very simple, because basically the Fed's mandate is to control, make prices stable, which is, controlling inflation and deflationary, pressures. Inflation, simply for me, is just too much money in circulation relative to the goods, which drives the prices up because you got more money than goods. And deflation for me is just too little money in circulation relative to goods. So you can have a lot of goods for sale, but if you have very little money to buy them, then it doesn't do a lot of good. You're going to have to lower the prices of those goods. So going forward, we are what I refer to as late cycle, meaning that I expect some kind of correction to occur. The thing that sort of supports that is the fact that, the earnings multiples, which are just how much the stock price is multiplied by what it actually earns in the stock market, they really were very high in the third quarter of last year. And it's just going to be very, very hard for companies at this point to take those earnings multiples out. So, you know, it's just like comps and real estate. You have comps and earnings multiples, and those things are very tough. Also, Europe and China had their earnings multiples peak in the third quarter of 2017, a full year before us. And while those economies have been weaker and selling off, they're going to become cheaper at some point. When the United States starts to sell off, I see people going into some of those cheaper assets elsewhere in the world, which is going to make our stock market go down. So that's sort of what's on the horizon. And now the Fed has to kind of look at this, you know, in the face of the political maelstrom, if there's a, not a better word. And they have to try, and they know, first of all, that markets contract. It's not if there's going to be another recession. It's when, it's how the money supply works. It sort of works like a breathing apparatus. It ebbs and it flows. And so they have to look at this and determine what to do with interest rates in the face of this situation, particularly since there was a lot of stimulus associated with the financial crisis. So what happens is they start to reduce their balance sheet and they start to raise interest rates, which we saw mostly last year. They raised actually nine times and started in 17. But they do this because they want to get interest rates up, because one of the ways that they combat, you know, a failing economy or slowing economy is by lowering interest rates. We don't have that much ammunition in the interest rates because we're only, you know, at 2.25% on the Fed funds target, which is just where they set a target. And then, of course, that interest rate is traded. And then, you know, we look at all of this and then we had our surprise, which is the repo operation that they had to do. That just simply meant that banks did not have enough cash on hand to meet the reserve requirement, which is how much they have to have in the building in ratio to what they are able to lend. So the Fed, you know, uses various means to inject short-term cash into the banking system. And so we sort of have this late cycle. We sort of have this emergency repo operation. And so those things are kind of in alignment with the narrative that the economy is going to be contracting very soon. But just recently, with the volatility in the market, the markets had a higher low from the previous iterations of volatility. And the volatility index, which is the VIX index, which measures the fear, because it basically measures how many people are buying insurance, didn't make a new high. So that tells me that in the short term, the market's going to continue to go higher, as we've seen today. It's looking for a trade agreement. It's looking for a Fed to commit to a more dovish standpoint, which means they're going to stimulate the economy. And that's in the short term. In the long term, I believe that equities are going to sell off.
That's very insightful. That's a lot of great information. And I have to say that that's a great assessment of the economy. I like to use this phrase that my crystal ball broke long time ago, and I can't find another one for sale. And it's very difficult to predict, but I agree with your directional view that we're certainly overpriced on the asset level. The PE is historically high. I don't know if you ever studied, there was a study done a long time ago, and so what it looked at is what happens when the PEs reach a certain level, the forward-looking PEs. And we're at a point where the return for the next 10 years, given the current PEs, should be, you know, on average, barely single digit, low single digits. You ever seen that theory? And is that something that you would subscribe to, or just, you know, the history changes? So we certainly, assets are very, very expensive, but who knows, right? I mean, the future could accelerate and not repeat itself the way it was in the past. So,
well, here's my sort of two-sided answer to that. And one is super dorky, but on the one hand, you know, valuations can stretch themselves unbelievably. I mean, I have some very sophisticated friends, and probably myself included, where we expected the market to sell off a bit sooner than it has, just because of the extension of valuations. So that is where history doesn't necessarily repeat itself. I mean, sometimes you can get an extension of valuations that we haven't seen before. However, that being said, moving over to the dorky side of the world, the mechanisms of debt which is what the Federal Reserve manages in order to run the monetary and economic system. The mechanisms of market trading, valuation, reversion to the mean, all of those sort of things haven't changed. And anytime you look at a growing asset, we think about this in technical analysis when we look at market charts, it's got to grow at a sustainable angle. And a sustainable angle is somewhere, based on the historical charts I've seen, about 11 degrees to 22 and a half degrees of a slope of growth. And that's a pretty sustainable angle. It doesn't take a lot of, you know, as much momentum to push that cart uphill. But if you think about pushing a cart uphill, and, you know, you start to see stocks go up at a 45 or higher degree angle, or any asset class, you just have to understand that you're pushing that cart at such a steep angle that it takes more gas or more fuel or more energy or whatever you want to call it to drive up at such a steep angle for a protracted period of time. So when that fuel source wanes just a little bit, you have a flattening out of that momentum, and that flattening out of the momentum, if it's going on too long or the fuel wanes for too long a period, is going to do what we call a reversion to the mean. So it's going to come back to a sustainable level. And so you have these big ups and big downs, but if you take those big ups and big downs and you kind of string them along over a long period of time, if there's growth in that asset, you're going to find yourself at somewhere between an 11 and a 22 degree angle. So that's my super dorky answer to that. So the thing is that we are going to have a big reversion to a big mean in this economy, because we have had the cart going at a very steep angle for an extended period of time, and those valuations have been really, really extended. And I'm not that surprised by that, because, you know, it went along with what we mentioned earlier, quantitative easing, where we were taking a record amount through asset purchases. We were taking a record amount of cash, which cash is debt, actually, and, you know, putting a record amount of money into the system. And so that record amount of money into the system provided a lot of fuel for that upward movement. But as that fuel starts to wane, obviously we have a reversion to the mean. And the repo operation that we've just discussed is sort of the early signs of, whoops, we need a little bit more fuel to keep this economy going.
That's a great point. The reversion to the mean theory, I certainly subscribe to it. I have a term that I use. It's called the law of economic gravity. So what comes up must come down, and it comes down to that mean. It's almost like this is the center of the gravity, and it pulls things back to where it needs to go, even though it gets too much up or too much down. So that's a great. I certainly subscribe to that. Let's come back to a real basic discussion. And I think you covered it by talking about money supply and the inflation. But how do you define the basics of inflation? What is inflation? And what's interesting is this. You see the CPI and how it measures inflation. And there's also sort of a street inflation. And it feels like the CPI undertracks the street inflation. Feels like the prices of the bread and milk go up faster than the CPI. So what is basics of inflation, and do you have any comments on this sort of the core versus headline inflation or CPI versus street inflation?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the two measurements of inflation, I mean, one very simply incorporates food and energy, and one very simply sort of doesn't add things like food and energy. And the reason is that food and energy can be a little bit more volatile than other goods and services that are measured in that basket of goods and services. You know, sometimes one number is more accurate than the other. It's a kind of a lagging indicator. I don't know if, you know, if I agree with all the lagging and leading indicators that are, you know, really well known in the system, but this is the way that it works. For me, inflation is too much money relative to goods. So if you can imagine, you know, you've got 10 loaves of bread and you've got $10, and, you know, sort of the ratio there is you're going to spend $1 per loaf of bread. Now, if you've got 10 loaves of bread and you've got $20, you know, that bread, in order for that money and that bread to meet in exchange, you're going to probably, the pricing is going to end up being $20 per loaf of bread. On the opposite side, if you have deflation, if you have 10 loaves of bread and you only have $5 in circulation, you either have to reduce the price or you can only actually buy a limited number of loaves if you don't reduce the price in time. And then you have a lot of inventory backed up and people that can't sell their products. And that's a deflationary era. That is when people are producing and yet they're not actually earning a living at their producing. So when you look at that, and then you look at the two inflation numbers, you know, when you have too much money in circulation per loaves of bread, those prices are going to go higher. And obviously in society, it's not as simple as a few loaves of bread and a few dollars. There are multiple variables. There's money coming in at different rates. There's debt maturing at different rates, and the money supply grows and recedes every nanosecond. Anytime somebody uses their Visa card, it grows. Anytime somebody pays off a loan, it shrinks. And so you use these averages and these inflationary numbers to kind of look at these baskets of goods to see if they're generally going up or generally going down, because it's just so impossible to measure the money supply moment to moment to moment. And the reason they have the two inflation numbers is because depending on the volatility in the food and energy, sometimes one of those numbers is more accurate than another number. So you also want to see if those numbers are in alignment, you know, if there's a difference between those numbers. And sometimes those things can indicate things.
Got you. That's a great way to explain it. Very simple, but brilliant. I completely understand. And this money supply, I guess, the Fed controls money supply. And one of their, I guess, key mandates is to maintain stable prices. And that's why this whole quantitative easing makes sense from time to time. But did you ever get a feeling, at least this was my feeling, that they were complacent for way too long? For a number of years, they kept the rates so low, and then they woke up one day, said we're behind the curve, and then they started raising rates. Was it late 2015 into 2016? And then they raised them too much too fast, and they overshot. Did you ever get that feeling?
Yeah. You know, what's interesting about it is that in the Great Depression, which is really what Bernanke was faced with when he was faced with the financial crisis, is sort of a reiteration of that kind of a deleveraging. Basically, you know, the market went topped out in 1929, it bottomed out in 1932. And then most people don't know this, but the stock market went straight up from 1932 to 1937 in the Great Depression. And the reason is because there was stimulus, and the stimulus helped the market recover. Now, what happened in 1937 is they decided that the stimulus created too much debt, because remember, all money in the end is debt, except if you're referring to coins, and there aren't that many coins in circulation. So what happened was they said, okay, the spending's too high, the debt's too high, so we're going to cut this debt and spending a little bit, because now, you know, we've had an upswing and we've recovered from this. Well, when they cut it a bit too drastically, and the markets fell, took that five-year gain and lost it in 1 year. So that was a problem. Notably, the 1938 low did not take out the 1932 low. But notably, after that fell, the stock market actually did not recover to its 1929 high until 1951. And of course, we had the iteration of World War II. But in looking at that, Bernanke said, okay, the error that was made when they cut the stimulus in 1937 was that they did not stimulate enough for long enough. So being faced with a similar situation, and actually mechanically an identical situation, Bernanke decided to stimulate a lot more for a lot longer. And that's where you got the quantitative easing, which again is an injection of cash into the system. And you also got, you know, interest rates obviously went to zero, and that carried on for quite a long time. Well, and then Yellen, yes, I'm sorry, I probably misspoke earlier, decided, when I said it was 17, I think it was late in 15 when they decided to start raising rates again. Although I don't have it in front of me, so don't hold me to
that. I remember, I think they started the reversion in late 2015 into 2016, at the very end of 2015, I think.
I think so too, but
it's probably close.
Yeah, sometimes on Friday afternoon, my blonde prevails, but no, I just always think about it as how many times they raised interest rates, and that's 9 times. But yes, you're right. They probably started in late 15. But the thing is that, you know, she decided that there's a lot of money in the system, which is a record, which equals a record amount of debt, and to kind of start tapering this a little bit so that we can raise interest rates so that they have the interest rates available if the market were to fall apart, because they lower interest rates. And that's one of the ways that they stimulate the economy. So in doing that, you know, she started doing that. Jay Powell took over with that sort of ideology. And of course, it's all voted upon. So it's not just one individual that's making that decision. And they did it a little too much. And so the market fell a little bit too much in December. But the thing to understand about the Fed is that they have targets, particularly with the Fed funds rate. I mean, they do control the discount rate, but the Fed funds rate is traded and they have a target. And so when they adjust it just a little bit, they know what variables that's eventually going to hit, but they don't know when it's going to hit the variable and at what rate it's going to hit those variables. And so then it makes it a little bit more difficult to ascertain how much of an effect these small adjustments are going to make, which is why I believe that they err sort of on the conservative side. You know, if Trump tweets, hey, cut interest rates by, you know, 50 basis points or a full percent, you know, they're more apt to cut a quarter point, even if ultimately we need 50 basis points, because they're more apt to do smaller movements until they see something taking effect. And so basically that's what's occurring at this point in time. We have a record amount of debt in the system. And if you cut too much, you reduce the money supply too much, then you can't service that record amount of debt. And so that's sort of the challenge that faces us today.
Right. So yeah, U.S. balance sheet, I think the whole system is just so over-leveraged to the nth degree. U.S. government debt, if this was a corporation, it would be bankrupt if its balance sheet looked like U.S. government balance sheet. But
to give you an idea, we were about 70-something percent to GDP in 2008. We are now about 120 to 125% debt to GDP.
So we went from 70 to 125 in short few years.
Well, during quantitative easing, right? Because all of that money that's being added to circulation is ultimately debt. And they say, well, why debt? You know, what is cash? What is debt? Well, the reason that the money system has a debt base, this is my theory, which is fairly mathematically sound, is just that, you know, if you just put money into circulation, then you just keep adding money to circulation and money never comes out of circulation, then you're going to eventually have endless inflation. And you should have bought everything yesterday. And it becomes very discriminatory against younger generations because their parents bought these assets so much cheaper than they did. And, you know, the assets are going to keep going up. And so that's what would occur. In order to have an elasticity in the money supply, where the money supply grows and ebbs and grows and ebbs and grows and ebbs, to keep this out of control inflation from occurring, debt does that very nicely. Because from a mechanical perspective, when debt is, you know, when you have debt, or, you know, you loan something into circulation, then that debt becomes part of the money supply. But when that debt matures, it comes out of the money supply. So there's an ebb and a flow.
I think that makes a lot of sense. Let's shift a little bit, a couple of other quick discussion points. So again, not having a crystal ball and projecting stock market in the long run to adjust down given the current high asset prices. What is a technical recession? How would you define, first of all, given the inverted yield curve, which, you know, is a leading indicator to a potential recession. Do you foresee a technical recession somewhere in 2020 or when? And what is a technical recession? Could you just explain that a little bit?
Yeah. So, I mean, without getting into too much complication with the inverted yield curve, I mean, basically the inverted yield curve is you're going to get, you know, a higher return on your short-term debt than your long-term debt. That's not good for liquidity in the bond markets, right? Because you want people to, in order to keep liquidity in the bond markets, you want people buying that long-term debt, buying and holding that debt. And it comes in times of uncertainty, you know, when people aren't sure what rates are going to do, or they just want faster maturations. And so, you know, that sort of is what occurs with the inverted yield curve. However, technically, recessions aren't necessarily called until long after the market high. For example, in October of 2007, you know, the market topped out in October of 2007, and the recession, I don't think, was called a technical recession until sort of late in 2008 when Lehman failed, if memory serves. So I don't personally pay a lot of attention to when somebody defines something as a recession, because from my standpoint, the market's already well been traded when somebody's going to call something a technical recession, because the technical recession is going to include variables that are lagging indicators. So a technical recession you know, a contraction of growth is probably the best definition for that. But what I really like to look at is market highs, because that's sort of what I do as an advisor and investor and, you know, somebody who has a fiduciary responsibility to my clients. And I don't want to wait for a recession to be called in order to adjust my stock market exposure, because that market's going to sell off well in advance. And you have to remember the old adage of, you know, you want to sell when everybody else wants to buy, and you want to buy when everybody else wants to sell. So I expect that the market's going to sort of count on the China trade deal, which I think Trump is very pressured to make, even though I'm apolitical. That's just sort of what I see. And the market really is waiting for Jay Powell to confirm that they're going to be dovish, which he's all but done. And I think that those things are much priced in. And I think we will see an uptick in the market if we actually get a trade deal or this goes through. But then I'm going to be very, very, very leery to stay in the market after that uptick, because we have a deceleration in economic growth. We don't have strong inflation numbers. And that sort of points to the end of the business cycle. Now, that being said, you know, if interest rates tick up a little bit, you could have a stagflationary scenario, which is simply defined as slowing growth and slightly rising inflation.
That's very, that's fascinating. As Mr. Spock would say, that is certainly an interesting view. And, but like the expression goes, all good things must come to an end. At least this bull run will come to an end probably soon. Maybe it's got a little bit more room to go with these short-term events, again, calming down trade friction with China and making a deal, and obviously confirmation from Jay Powell that they are accommodating the economy and the whole thing. A couple of final questions, and because we're running out of time. So if you had a three to 5 year time horizon and you looked at real estate, just let's use real estate as something that you wanted to consider investing in, and we invest in real estate, that's all we do per se. A lot of investors are just a little bit concerned. Again, real estate prices are also inflated in many markets for many type of assets, and low falling interest rates is great fuel for real estate prices. But the economy, slowing economy, could certainly hurt occupancy and a number of other metrics that support the prices. So what do you think about just real estate as a sector in general for next 3 to 5 years? Do you feel that it's going to stay stable? It certainly is a hedge against inflation. We see some level of inflation, real estate should do well. Any thoughts just on the next 3 to 5 years in real estate? I know it's a very hard question and hard to buy a crystal ball nowadays. So,
yeah, I definitely want those crystal balls. Yeah, we haven't had a trend. You're going to have me back, because we don't really have a confirmation as to whether or not we're headed into a deflationary scenario or we're going to have the softer landing of stagflation. In the deflationary scenario, obviously real estate investments, they're going to lose money. I think rentals do very well because people are less inclined to buy and real estate prices are going to go down. That's what happens typically in a deflationary area. I mean, sometimes New York will do it at a different rate than another location. I mean, for instance, Reno is the fastest growing city in America and has a real inventory problem. So that's going to be affected differently than New York City, which now has too much inventory, arguably. So those factors do play in. If we have a stagflationary scenario or more of a soft landing, you do have inflation, as you say, ticking up a little bit, and then real estate remains a good hedge against inflation. I am not inclined to make any bets one way or the other at the moment. I'm really waiting to see how this October is traded. I'm really waiting to see how the market, you know, reacts to the Fed this month. And I'm really kind of waiting to see what happens with the trade talks to kind of go, all right, you know, how bad is this going to be? And, you know, is this going to be the big reversion to the mean, or do we still have time in the market? So I am hesitant to make a great prediction on real estate in the next 3 to 5 years, but you'll definitely have to have me back when things settle out and there's more of a, you know, a confirmed trend.
Yeah, that's a great point. If I hear you correctly, it's now the trend is broken. We really have to be very tactical, looking at the data, and be very, very nimble and dynamic in this environment, because the environment is no longer a sure thing. It could go either way. So uncertainty is, it feels like there's more uncertainty now. So quick question.
Certainly.
certainly there is more uncertainty.
That's right.
If folks wanted to reach out to you, is there a good email, website, if they have questions, if they would like to just invite you to speak on an economic subject or something, is there a good way to reach you?
Yes, you can email me at frances@optimalcapital.com. So that's frances@optimalcapital.com. And you can email me there. And yeah, I'd be delighted to answer your questions. Hopefully I can answer your questions. And anyway, it's been a wonderful pleasure to be with you today. And please have me back when we have less uncertainty. And I hope you guys have a great rest of your day.
Thank you so much, Frances. I would love to have you back, even when the environment is both certain or uncertain. It's certainly been great pleasure and a privilege. Thank you kindly for coming on the podcast.
Yes, thank you, Mike. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. To receive your copy of Mike's How to Choose a Smart Real Estate Fund book, head to BigMikeFund.com or visit Amazon and type Mike's Zlotnick. Keep listening and keep investing Big Mike style. See you on the next episode.